Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Mark Stern, staff writer at Slate covering courts and the law, joins me to discuss a lawsuit leveled against the Biden administration by a former Trump appointee and how Biden's Department of Justice might be falling into a right-wing trap.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey, don't forget, this program relies on your support. If you want to support this show, head to rofpodcast.com. And when you become a member, not only do you support the free show, but we give you extra content. This week, I'll be talking to Sophia Gourlay and Jenny Hernandez. They are immigration attorneys and defense attorneys about the jail to deportation pipeline that exists in this country. Fascinating stuff. It's an interview I did about a month ago, still, sadly, very relevant. You can listen to it if you become a member. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. So, Heather, it has been quite a week when it comes to the sort of the staple of our politics at this moment, which is centered around the infrastructure bill, and not just the infrastructure bill, but also we had a big vote on the voting rights bill over the past week, and the sort of fallout from that failure and the Republican filibuster. I guess maybe we should start with the voting rights because there is some argument that in losing the vote for the For the People Act by a 50-50 margin, more or less, I mean, it was a filibuster, but we had 50 Democrats voting to end debate, that the Democrats that this should be a hopeful sign for another iteration of the voting rights. It is, it's one of those things where you sort of have to laugh to keep from crying, because this is, this can't have been the strategy of the Biden administration or the Democrats when this began. It just feels like it's been slow walked so much that events have overtaken everything else.
I think you're right. I mean, the idea that this is somehow a good sign that all 50 Republicans voted against it and they were all there for the vote. I mean, again, they didn't vote against the actual bill because that wasn't even allowed to come to the floor to be debated, where they were just saying that we're not even going to talk about this. And they couldn't even get three or four. They couldn't even get Mitt Romney to vote along with this. So how that's a good sign, I don't know. But, you know, I think you and I talked about this a couple weeks ago. The strategy, from what we understood at one point, was that the Democrats were going to put a bunch of, you know, quote, message bills on the floor or whatever, bills that they knew were going to fail. And that somehow or another, this was going to teach Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin and the other, you know, however many there are, 8, 10, 5, whatever, Democrats who don't want to be named, that the filibuster is absolutely necessary if they want to advance the Democratic agenda while they have the majority. That was supposedly the idea. And a lot of these Democrats seemed very enthusiastic about this. This was really going to show Manchin that there's no point in, you've got to go with the filibuster, we're not going to get anything done at all, and we're going to be a failure, and you're going to be the instrument of Joe Biden's presidency going down and losing the House and Senate in 2022. Well, I don't see that that's happening. I mean, maybe, but Sinema and Manchin seem as adamant as ever, and even after the bill failed, the bill to proceed to debate failed this week, Manchin came out and they interviewed him walking through the halls or whatever. And he said, well, you know, I just don't understand that I offered, and he did, he offered a reasonable compromise, which was he gave away voter ID and he gave away purging all the, you know, the voter rolls around, a lot of things that had been on the Republican wish list for many years. He cobbled together this compromise and said, look, you know, and got all the Democrats to sign on to it. And they were not happy about it either. They did not want to do that, but they did it. And they all voted for the bill. All 50 of the Democrats did, plus Kamala Harris. It didn't do any good. They couldn't even get Mitt Romney on there. So you would think that that would do that, but it doesn't seem to have made it budge. And then now later in this week, as we're seeing today, they did come together in some bipartisan fashion. We don't know if it, well, they, you know, got a deal for this infrastructure bill, whether that goes anywhere, you know, who knows. But at this point, it appears that there is some bipartisanship, the holy grail of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. So that whole thing has backfired, as far as I can tell. I mean, if the whole point of this was to prove to Manchin and Sinema that nothing could get done, and then they go and pass a bipartisan, or they come to a bipartisan agreement for an infrastructure deal, well, I just don't think that's a very good strategy. But, you know, again, maybe that's all they've got. I don't know.
Well, all right, and we'll get to that. I want to stay on the voting rights thing for a moment, but the broader argument that you're making, ostensibly, which was, and you know, this came out. I think the Intercept audio may have come out. It was on Thursday night, and it may have been last week, right after we recorded for last week, although we addressed it. I can't remember, but the point being is that Manchin, in that audio that was leaked from his phone call with the billionaire funders, clearly was feeling the pressure from the failure of the Republicans to sign on to the Capitol Attack Commission. And that bill was considered the most bipartisan bill that could exist. Right, it was like the most hypothetical of partisan bills. It incorporated everything that Kevin McCarthy requested in the bill, and so the development of the bill was bipartisan, and the execution and the construction of the commission that the bill was fashion to do was also bipartisan. It, you know, very often when you have committees like this, the majority gets an extra person or two. Maybe it's relative to the division in the Senate itself. This was 50-50. Very often the majority will give themselves subpoena power, but the minority, they'll say, you only get to subpoena two witnesses. You can call as many as you want, but you can only get to subpoena two. In this instance, Republicans had the exact same subpoena power as the Democrats. So people get the gist. This was the most hypothetically bipartisan of bills. And Manchin was aware that if we can't get this done, I can't go out there and pretend that bipartisanship is possible, because this is the most obvious bill to pass. And so will you please hire Roy Blunt and, you know, overpay him essentially for, you know, some type of no-show job or something like that, so that he will see the value in voting for this. And while you're at it, Burr is retiring. He might need a job too. And anybody else you can find. And it was that type of deal. And so your broader point of, like, any bipartisan deal that is supposedly struck undercuts the argument that we need to have filibuster reform. Now, let me just push back on that and say that hopefully that concern is premature, right? Just because Joe Biden came out and supported this bipartisan bill doesn't mean it's going to pass in the Senate. And we will get to that in a moment. But from the voting rights perspective, Manchin came out with this bill. Stacey Abrams said, good enough for me in terms of, like, from a practical standpoint. Roy Blunt, There he is again, says, oh, well, if Stacey Abrams likes it, then it must be bad. And the idea was that if Joe Manchin joined the Democrats in, you know, the procedural vote, it was an indication that there was some cohesion within the Democratic caucus. And, you know, it's not inconceivable. And again, that audio, leaked audio, comes into play, that we could see something that was like a talking filibuster or some type of, like, you know, filibuster reform that doesn't, quote unquote, weaken the filibuster, but maybe also it's limited to voting rights. I mean, we don't know. But the chances definitely go down if Joe Manchin feels he can still, with a straight face, sell the idea that bipartisanship is possible in this era, and therefore we don't need any filibuster reform. And so, you know, this is going to be a big test. Now, on Wednesday of this week, the Biden administration was sort of leaking that, and the Republicans were certainly sort of acting as if the White House had come close to walking away by saying that the pay-fors that the Republicans were acquiring, which was taking money from COVID relief and gas tax and a tax on electric vehicles, were non-starters for Joe Biden. And it seemed like it was dead in the water, which was a good thing, because there are provisions in there that we need to talk about that are very problematic. And like you say, on Thursday of this week, Joe Biden is out there having like a ceremony with, now to be clear, he only did it with the Gang of 10, which is five Republicans and five Democrats. That Gang of 10 cannot pass anything. Even if you get all Democrats on there, we are still at 55 votes. And the filibuster requires, the filibuster requires only 40 Republican votes. And there's 45 Republican votes ostensibly there. So there, that other five is always going to be the real question, right? I mean, that's where we're at. The Gang of 10 has to convince the other five.
That's right. And it may not, I mean, I'm not even sure that all the Democrats are signing on to this. I mean, the assumption is that they will, but, you know, there are things in there that are problematic. There was a piece this week in the American Prospect by Dave Dayan, who looked very closely at what we knew of the infrastructure bill, which, you know, who knows what's changed since then. But presumably they're operating from a certain framework that's, you know, been fairly, you know, consistent. And he says we're looking at a lot of sort of what used to be called, Naomi Klein, I think, is the one who coined this phrase, disaster capitalism, which is that, you know, you spend a lot of federal money on a bunch of private enterprises that then get to reap the profits from all of these things as they go. I mean, we saw this after Katrina, for instance. There was this huge push, you know, we're going to rebuild New Orleans, we're going to do this, that, and the other. And the way that what was revealed what they were doing was basically privatizing a bunch of what had previously been publicly owned institutions and various things. So there's a lot of this. There is, you know, there's a reason why these Republicans that are working on this infrastructure bill are more enthusiastic about it than other things. And, you know, also, of course, it's a jobs bill. It brings jobs to their states. There is money to be had there. And that's always, you know, I mean, that's part of the deal with these things, right? I mean, they're going to be building roads and somebody's going to have to build them. So that's great. But there's a lot about this bill that we don't know yet. And what we do know, there are some problems there. And I would suspect there will be some people, you know, some Democrats who are going to want to take a real close look at this centrist negotiated bill, which they have had zero input in, right? I mean, this has been between Kyrsten Sinema, you know, Mark Warner, Joe Manchin. I mean, who are the other two Democrats that have been on that?
Tester.
John Tester. And I can't remember who the other one is. But, you know, these are not what you – there's not representative of, I don't think,
Angus King, I think it was.
Yeah, that's right. Right. And, you know, and then the usual suspects on the Republican side, you know, and so they have a right to be skeptical, too. So we don't know whether or not this is going to happen. I think the idea being that Joe Biden came out and endorsed the thing that gives a whole bunch of Democrats, you know, the either pressure or, you know, permission to go along with it. But this is not a done deal. And yet, what it does show, I mean, let's assume that the thing fails. Joe Manchin can still say, hey, look, we had this bipartisan thing. And if the Democrats, if any of the, you know, Bernie Sanders says, no, I'm not going to sign in, or Warren says, I won't do it. Look at what happened.
He'll blame the Democrats. I mean, this is the dilemma, right, for the progressives here. I mean, it remains to be seen. If they can go into this, and there's a whole nother aspect of this in terms of like the way that Pelosi responded and the plans to go with reconciliation in a sort of dual track, and not as an alternative, but as it depends on your perspective, but a supplement, a complement. Really the main course, and this being and the bipartisan thing being supplementary. But the point being that there is a very big political dilemma here for progressives, because if they balk at this bill early, it gives Joe Manchin a talking point and a rationale to not get rid of the filibuster, because he's saying, look, this was a bipartisan bill, and it was just the left of the Democratic Party was the ones who killed it, as opposed to progressives holding their fire initially to get an indication if those other five Republicans, and frankly, I honestly don't know where they're going to come from, are willing to sign on. I mean, Mitch McConnell has sort of laid out, you know, he's the one who lays out the tune, and the rest of them sing to it. And Mitch McConnell does not want anything to pass. He believes obstruction is the key to a 2022 win. So it's an interesting dilemma. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about those plans to do this sort of dual track with the reconciliation. I'm at a loss, but I hope that you are not. We will take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this. So, Heather, in the last segment, we are talking about the sort of, I think this has come up in the past, like, you know, we often just see shadows, really, is what we are analyzing, right? Because we don't know exactly what's going on and with these dynamics. And we try and extrapolate from the public facing proclamations as to what's actually going on. This week saw sort of two sides, I want to say, of the same coin, maybe. And I'm not even sure they're different sides. Maybe it's two sides of the same dice. And there's a couple other sides. But we saw the Voting Rights Act, the For the People Act, go down to a filibuster. And I want to swing back on that, because you've written a lot about what's going on in the states this week as to the need for that bill, or some type of voting rights bill. And then we saw on the sort of the flip side of that was what appears to be, or at the very least, and maybe most dangerously, could be represented as a bipartisan agreement on an infrastructure bill. Now, It is, in some sense, a bipartisan agreement on an infrastructure bill. You have 10 people. They're from two different parties. They agree. It is not a bipartisan coalition that, at this point, seems to have the ability to pass an infrastructure bill, right? Like, it's no more relevant than if I was to sit down with my, you know, Republican neighbor and we agree on the infrastructure bill. That's great. But we don't have the ability to pass it unless they have an extra five Republicans. And unless every Democrat is on board with it, they will not pass it. And let's talk about that that provision David Dayan wrote about, which was a public-private partnership that is ostensibly supposed to make it possible for the federal government to avoid expenditures, massive expenditures, by selling off the leasing or ownership rights, essentially, of these things that are public investments, so that to the extent that they accrue money, that money can be accrued by hedge funds, essentially. And Dayan used the example, and I remember this well, Chicago back in 2009, I believe it was in a slight fiscal crisis, not a dramatic one, but a slight one. And they sold off all the parking meters to a private company, or I think it was a hedge fund. And basically what they did is for the money that they got for those was not terribly significant. It was okay, a short term, I don't know, $1 billion. But over the course of the 10 or 12 years or whatever it was that they essentially leased them out, there was a 10, 12 times that revenue. Plus, they had no control over whether that private enterprise raised the prices of parking. They had no control. They had to pay that company if they ever shut down the street for, I don't know, COVID that happens, or parade, or whatever it is. It was just a really bad deal. And, you know, you likened it to disaster capitalism. And in many respects, it is, right? I mean, it's like some crisis that it comes about because the government, because Republicans decide we can't pay for this. And therefore, we go out, we basically privatize the we socialize the risks, we privatize the profits, and that's what's happening there. And that is going to be a big problem for Democrats, or at least some of the progressive Democrats. But like we said at the end of the last segment, do you come out and announce you're against the bill and then give Joe Manchin like a get out of jail free card, or do you just basically call the bluff and say, okay, I'm very interested in about, you know, numbers 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 Republicans who are going to vote for this bill. And if they don't, we're just back where we started. And there's a plan to basically dual track with reconciliation. Tell us, to the extent that we know what that is, tell us what that is.
Well, I've heard two different things on that since the, and this is just as this bipartisan bill was agreed to, publicly agreed to, and Biden signed on. So who knows where that's going to go. But from what I understand, there are two different possibilities here, and I don't think they've reconciled it yet. One is Biden says that he expects these to go through Congress in tandem, that the reconciliation bill will be, you know, the Democrats will be negotiating among themselves over the reconciliation side of it, which is the infrastructure for people stuff. You know, it's all the health care and elder care and child, you know, care and that sort of thing. And that Biden genuinely seems to want to get. I mean, I do get the sense that he feels that's an important part of his agenda and legacy, and he really wants to get that. Whether he can get that, it remains to be seen. But that was his idea. I'll sign on to this bipartisan deal, but we're going to have to get this reconciliation thing done too. Now, why does he have private agreements with Manchin? And I think more importantly on this thing, it's Sinema, who's the real fulcrum of the potential resistance among Democrats. She was the one who took credit for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. She was featured very heavily in the public celebration that they held. So I have a feeling she may be more of a focus here even than Manchin. But having said that, Nancy Pelosi came out immediately after this was announced and said, well, we're not moving on this bipartisan bill until we get the reconciliation bill passed. Now, did she mean that to be that that has to go first? Because that's how I read it. And I don't know whether that's not tandem, that's going first. So perhaps they're, it's hard for me to believe that they're not talking to each other. Ron Klain is a sophisticated fellow when it comes to dealing with Congress. And I have a feeling that this is all taking staking out negotiating positions. But one thing that's really important to remember, Republicans have a completely different incentive here than the Democrats do. And it's really crude and really basic. The Republicans may all want these jobs for their states. They may think that's great and they want these people, you know, they might genuinely feel that repairing bridges. I mean, we did just have a building collapse down in Florida today, right? A huge condo. So things are not, you know, our country's falling apart. So they may genuinely want to do something like this. But on a political basis, they have very little incentive to do that. I don't think any of these are these senators that are running. I guess Lisa Murkowski up in Alaska, I'm sure she wants a bridge to nowhere or something up there. That Alaska is hugely dependent on federal projects like this. It's a big deal for them up there. Having said that, if she loses her election, it'll be to another Republican. So I don't think Mitch McConnell cares at all, really, about whether or not it's Lisa or somebody else up there. And as far as I can tell, among the five, there's nobody in that group that's really in danger and needs to have an infrastructure project in their state, or they're going to lose their seat next time. And that is where the incentives are. For Democrats, it's everything. To pass these bills, to get this thing happening, to show success, to show Joe Biden is getting things done and the Democrats in the majority can deliver for the people. The Republican incentive is the exact opposite.
Right.
It's to show that nothing gets done. These people are just a bunch of, you know, a bunch of shallow promises that they can't deliver on. And you basically, you don't want to give them this power. So to me, whenever I look at this, these negotiations get very Byzantine and you're watching it, you know, who, you know, what position are they taking and who's on first and who's on second. But really, you have to always come back to that. What are the incentives for these people to actually do any of this stuff? And it remains obvious. Mitch McConnell has made it clear that his goal is to stop and obstruct the Democratic agenda. And so let's not forget that. I'm not saying it's impossible, because it's not impossible. There are reasons why. I mean, maybe some of those people actually have a conscience and want to fix the bridges and the roads. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's actually, you know, part of the equation here. But let's not forget that when it comes to the politics of it, there is a very, very strong and very obvious divide as to what these people need to accomplish.
Yep. And I would just say, as we wrap up here, that it occurs to me that if there is an understanding of this dynamic in the Senate and in the White House and in the House, we are going to see the House be the problem, as opposed to any Senate. So in other words, we will see Pelosi and AOC come out and say, we're not voting for this. And Sanders will keep his powder dry so that Manchin cannot have the excuse. We had a bipartisan deal. And
Right. Makes perfect sense. Yeah.
We shall see. We will check back with you next week and maybe we'll know a little bit more. Heather, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
In its quest to root out the extreme Trump administration appointees still left in government, the Biden administration may have walked itself into a right-wing trap. A new lawsuit leveled at the administration could undermine future governmental agency independence, which would have far-reaching implications. Here to break this down is Mark Stern, staff writer at Slate, covering courts and the law, whose piece on this is entitled Biden's Justice Department is Walking into a Trap Set by Trump Appointees. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So let's just start off by setting the stage here. Biden has been, understandably, rooting out many of the extreme Trump appointees that have been placed throughout the executive branch, including ones burrowed into positions traditionally considered career positions, which are separate from political positions. I'll ask you to expand on that a bit. But it just means it's harder for them to be fired, pretty much, even if they are expressly political, as Trump changed the game. So this all seems legitimate, Biden's actions here. How is there a lawsuit?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, burrowing in is this tactic that some presidents have used to try to keep their people in the executive branch long after they themselves have left the White House. And there's a couple different ways you can do it. And you just described the main method, which is taking a position that's typically apolitical, that's typically staffed by an expert or a career civil servant, and placing in that spot an extreme partisan. Similarly, some presidents, including Trump, will reappoint individuals who have already been placed in the executive branch shortly before leaving office so that their terms start anew, so that hopefully, if it works out, the sort of dead hand of the last administration will still be governing or at least holding back the new administration. And this is what Donald Trump did with a number of agencies, including this relatively small one called the Administrative Conference of the United States, which I'll just call AACUS. That's how it's universally referred to. And you may remember Roger Severino. He was the head of Trump's campaign to really gut the civil rights protections in healthcare that were part of the Affordable Care Act. Roger Severino led the Department of Health and Human Services division that was created to legalize the denial of care to LGBTQ people and to women on grounds of religion. But he also moonlighted at this other conference, this other agency again, I'll call AACUS, where he helped to kind of craft these best practices, these standards that would enshrine really conservative, anti-government, anti-regulatory principles into federal law. And Trump reappointed Severino to AACUS just 4 days before he left the White House. And Joe Biden pretty understandably came into office and said, you know what, Roger Severino, you were put here under pretty dubious circumstances. You do not reflect my administration. I am going to remove you from this agency. But Severino turned around and sued, which leads us to where we are now with Severino v. Biden, where a former Trump administration official is suing President Biden to try to get his job back.
Right. Well, we'll get to that in a second, because is it to get his job back? Right. We don't
really know.
That's not clear. And I would argue that it's very unlikely. I'm hoping that you could expand a little bit more on Severino's background. I mean, the fact that he was trying to accomplish the tasks that you listed says a lot in and of itself. But he has a history of being an advocate, or the opposite, an activist against LGBTQ rights. And that was primarily, I think, why he was so attractive to the Trump administration. If you could tell us a little bit about this guy.
Right. So attractive that he had two different jobs within the Trump administration.
Right.
So Roger Severino is the husband of Carrie Severino, who is sort of the ringleader of the dark money campaign for conservative judges. She helped to vet and select and promote and lobby for a lot of Trump's judicial nominees, including all three of his Supreme Court justices. And Roger Severino, her husband, does kind of similar work, but more in the background. He was for a very long time a civil rights litigator, but his main job was litigating against LGBTQ equality and also litigating against abortion access and access to contraception. So he would take on cases that tried to establish non-discrimination principles at hospitals or other institutions and organizations to say, well, you know, all people people have to be served equally here. Gay and transgender people have to be served and treated equally. Roger Severino would accuse those organizations of attacking religion, of violating the religious liberty of anti-LGBTQ people, and sue to either try to knock down non-discrimination laws or carve huge exceptions into non-discrimination laws that you could sort of drive a truck through that would, of course, undermine the very purpose of the law in the first place. So when he was put at the head of this so-called religious liberty civil rights division within the Trump administration, it was very clear that he was only arguing for civil rights for a select group of people, for individuals who want to turn away LGBTQ people, who do not support abortion or even access to contraception, and who think that federal law should be sort of shredded in terms of its protection for LGBTQ people and women, and rewritten to allow widespread discrimination against these sort of disfavored groups.
So in essence, he's just a real stand-up guy. Right. And then and I also would ask if you could give the audience a sense of what ACUS, the agency that he was a part of on a part-time basis, how it was supposed to function, and then how it functioned differently under the Trump administration.
Yeah. So to take a step back, this is sort of like civics 101, but I think it's important. Most of what the government does is like kind of boring regulatory stuff. So like the Department of Education, the Department of Labor, Health and Human Services, all of these agencies that we know and may love or may not love, they spend a lot of time looking at federal laws that give these really broad goals. Like Congress will tell the Environmental Protection Agency, you need to clean the air, figure out what clean air means and figure out how to get there. And the EPA will say, okay, well, we're going to pass some rules to keep mercury out of the air, to limit carbon emissions, to limit coal emissions, to, you know, achieve the goals that Congress has set. There's a lot of action that goes on there that doesn't get as much attention as I tend to think it deserves. And ACUS is this a kind of obscure agency that helps to sort of push that process in one direction or another. So what I mean by that is when it was founded, the goal was to just make government work really well, help the EPA figure out how you write those rules that really do keep mercury out of the air, that keep lead out of pipes, that make sure we're all breathing healthy, clean air. And the idea was, let's put experts here in the federal government who know how this stuff works, because it's a very rarefied field. Most people are not experts in this kind of law. Let's have them sort of advise the president and advise these agencies how to do their work in the best way possible. And that was a good goal. And it really, ACUS functioned that way for a long time. But under Trump, it changed directions. And what happened was Trump stacked it with these kind of industry-friendly lawyers, individuals who had spent a long time lobbying for either like pollution or for discrimination like Severino, stuff that Republicans want and like. And at that point, ACUS really veered directions. And instead of saying, here's some best practices to make government work, ACUS said, here's some best practices to achieve the Republican Party's agenda under the guise of making government work. So EPA to consider in human lives when evaluating a certain pollutant. You know, let's tell the EPA, you shouldn't care about kids dying from lead in pipes. You should just care about how much money we're spending on those new pipes. Let's tell the Department of Health and Human Services, it doesn't really matter if LGBTQ people face discrimination. Let's just focus on the hospitals themselves and what their rights are. Tilting the playing field away from basic good government stuff to the kind of, I think, really bad, evil stuff that the Republican Party wants. That is what ACUS did under Trump. And that is what it was set to continue doing under Biden, because Trump stacked it full of really extreme sort of radical conservative activists.
Right. I mean, this is the minutia that goes mostly unnoticed. But as you mentioned, it has such a ripple effect in terms of the functioning and the way that government policy is implemented. And so you're talking about ACUS as an agency, which, you know, its makeup is, I think, incredibly important to understanding this case. So could you just let the audience know How ACUS is staffed. I mean, there's, I think, what, 10 members that are mm-hmm. appointed by the president, and how that's integral to understanding the lawsuit that we'll dive into after this.
Yeah, so ACUS has a chairman in the law, a chairperson, who is nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And that individual generally has some measure of independence to direct the agency. And Donald Trump put forth this guy named Jonathan Mitchell, a longtime union-busting conservative activist, to be the chair of ACUS. And the Senate actually did not take up his confirmation. And so Trump ended up not putting in a chair for this agency. What he did instead was appoint members to the council, which, as you mentioned, is 10 people. And the great thing about the council, if you're Trump, is that you don't need Senate confirmation to put people there. All you do is put out their names and voila, they are part of ACUS. So Trump decided to put people like Roger Severino and some other very extreme conservatives like Andrew Kloster onto this council because he knew he didn't have to deal with the Senate. He didn't have to worry about getting 51 votes. These folks, these 10 folks on the council, could just be placed there by presidential decree, and they have a term of 3 years, which means unless somebody intervened, as Biden has, but we'll get to that, they would have been serving well past the midpoint of Joe Biden's first term.
Right. And that's why it is a good thing that Biden intervened. But this, as you write, was clearly something that the Trump administration anticipated. And there is a trap that was set that it seems like the Biden administration is falling right into. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, what a teaser, we will be discussing that very trap. So now this Severino figure is suing the Biden administration. And suing and saying that the president doesn't have the authority, essentially, right, to get rid of him from this position. The lawsuit in and of itself and the arguments that they're making really fly in the face of conservative thought for the past few decades. And we can get into that in and of itself. But first, if you could just give us the lay of the land of this lawsuit.
Yeah. So Trump appointed Severino along with three other individuals toward the end of his term. And as I mentioned, he actually reappointed Severino again, just to like really extend his term as far into Biden's first term as possible. And it seems very clear that everyone involved understood that this was sort of like a risk, that this wasn't necessarily going to stick, that Biden wasn't necessarily going to put up with it, but that they were all going to try because deregulation was one of Trump's main priorities. And it didn't get as much attention as it may have deserved, but these folks in ACUS could have played a role in continuing to push deregulation from their perch at this agency. But in early February, Joe Biden fired four of the most extreme members of ACUS who Trump had put there, including Severino. Severino refused to accept his termination. He refused to step down. He refused to resign. And so the president had to actually explicitly say, "You are fired from this conference, Mr. Severino."
Yes, taking a page out of his predecessor's book there. Yeah, stepping on his most famous line.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And at that point, I think Severino realized he was fired. But then he turned around and filed a lawsuit, which we will get into. But what's important to note is that the lawsuit argues that Joe Biden has no power to fire a member of this executive agency, even a member who wasn't even confirmed by the Senate, which is an argument that completely contradicts pretty much everything the conservative legal movement has been insisting for like 40 to 50 years.
Yeah, and especially because it was a crescendo in the Bush years, and then and subsequently in the Trump years, the unitary executive theory that essentially the president has unilateral power to do all kinds of things, at the very least this. So there, it seems like they're targeting a precedent set by a 1935 Supreme Court decision called Humphrey's Executor. What does that entail, and why is this particular argument by Severino's legal team so divergent from the conservative orthodoxy that, as you say, has been so dominant for the past many decades.
Yeah. So in 1935, in Humphrey's executor, the Supreme Court said that Congress actually can create multi-member executive agencies and can prevent the president from firing the people who are on those agencies. So there it was the Federal Trade Commission, which is still around and still really important. The members of the Federal Trade Commission have protection against being fired by the president. You know, if a president comes in and says, I don't like the folks that my predecessor put on the FTC, the president can't just fire them and replace them because of this decision called Humphrey's executor. Congress is able to say, actually, you're going to have to deal with this because we want these agencies to be run by real experts in a kind of nonpartisan way. And that plays out all across the government. So think about the Securities and Exchange Commission. Think about the Federal Reserve. Think about the FCC. All of these agencies that are historically independent, the president doesn't get to just come into office and fire everybody in those agencies. He has to wait for an opening. And that's something that conservatives and Republicans historically really don't like, because they believe in this unitary executive theory that says, well, all of the executive power sits with the president. And so the president gets to fire basically whoever he wants. So if, you know, Donald Trump had come into office and said, I don't really like these folks Obama put on the Federal Reserve, I'm just going to fire all of them and replace them with morons and lunatics who want to go back to the gold standard, according to unitary executive theory, he could have. I myself think that is a bad thing. I think it's good that there is actual independence for these agencies, because going back to what we were talking about before, experts do really well when they're given a little space and a little breathing room to figure out what the best policies are. And so when Roger Severino sued after Biden fired him from an agency, my first thought was, how could that possibly be? Roger Severino, you are the rank and file Federalist Society member. You are the quintessence of the conservative legal movement. Everything that you and your people have been saying for the last 50 years contradicts what you are claiming in this lawsuit. If you believe in any form of the unitary executive theory, you should not blink before acknowledging that Joe Biden has the power to fire you from this agency.
Right. Except, of course, he's not operating in good faith. So that makes it easy. But the fundamental issue here is that ACUS is not in the vein of the agencies that you describe. Is that accurate?
Yeah. And that is probably going to be the real issue for Severino, as we can discuss. But ACUS is not like the Federal Reserve. Okay. ACUS was not envisioned as this bastion of independence where experts would be totally shielded from politics. Yes, it was supposed to be pretty apolitical, but no one thought it was so important that it needed these special protections. And so there's nothing in federal law, nothing at all, that protects people like Severino from being fired by the president at will. Yes, they get a term of 3 years, but there's just like dozens of precedents that say a term is the maximum limit that someone can serve. It's not the floor. So the fact that Severino could have served up to 3 years is not generally interpreted to mean that he had some protection against getting fired earlier than that.
Right. I mean, they don't have like regulatory authority, or I mean, it's essentially an arm of the executive branch, so that this makes sense. This is what happens, and that's why there are separate laws for different kinds of agencies.
Right.
But this is what's the trap. We've been teasing this to this point. DOJ representing Biden, they're essentially making the argument that the courts don't have the power to say that a president has to reinstate someone who's been fired at an agency.
Right.
Why is that problematic? To me, it's like, okay, this is not the layup legal theory that we've been, or argument that we've been, I think, kind of dancing around or buttressing throughout our conversation. This
right.
seems entirely separate, and that's problematic in terms of precedent.
Right. So it's not a good argument, just like taking it on its own terms, we just walked through the fact that there's no legal protections for these AKUS members. There's nothing in federal law that says they get to serve no matter what the president thinks. That should be the main argument. But for the Justice Department, it's not. The main argument is, as you said, that federal courts have no power to force a president to reinstate a member of an agency who was fired illegally. Now, pause and think about what that means. It means that what we have been taught for the last 90 years by the Supreme Court in Humphrey's executor and other cases, that actually agencies can be independent, that actually they can be protected from the president, that that's not really true. Because at the end of the day, if the president chooses to fire a member of the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Federal Reserve or the FTC or whatever, I mean, it might be illegal in theory, but the federal courts have no power to put that person back in their place. And so that would mean the death knell of independent agencies, and it would mean the kind of de facto establishment of the unitary executive, which is not something that historically progressives, including like the Biden administration, have ever wanted.
So that begs the question, why? I mean, right. Why are they not taking the case on its merits, and they're making some sort of parallel argument? It seems nonsensical, as you say.
So I think that the Justice Department feels a kind of institutional pressure to protect the president at all costs. And I think, you know, we've seen this over the last couple of weeks with some very disappointing decisions that Merrick Garland has made.
Well, I mean, it's just I'm sorry to cut you off. It's just the fetishization of institutions and process overall. I mean, that's the Achilles heel of the Biden administration and his staff.
I completely agree. And we've seen this with the E. Jean Carroll lawsuit, where Merrick Garland is defending Trump position. We've seen this with the Barr memo that Merrick Garland is still defending, keeping secret in court. Again, over and over again, we've seen Biden and Merrick Garland adhere to these positions that Trump had taken because, well, we have to preserve the institution. We have to protect it and restore its independence. Those process arguments don't really work when the guys before you were operating in total bad faith. And by preserving independence, you're just upholding all of the terrible positions that they took. And I think that's part of what's going on here. You've got Justice Department lawyers who are very smart and very good at their jobs being told, like, our goal still is to protect the president. And if you want to take a position that's maximally protective of the president, then sure, argue that federal courts don't get to tell the president what to do. But that is a position that's going to lead to some extreme consequences down the road that would seem to directly clash with what this president has said he stands for and believes in.
So also, I mean, just a hilarious wrinkle to it. We touched on it earlier, but Severino is... Why it's ridiculous that the DOJ is running with this is because Severino's argument is on such shaky ground in and of itself. He's trying to claim he wants his job back. I mean, this is not the prestigious kind of position. Everything that, you know, a guy like Severino wants is to use that kind of position in the executive branch as a springboard for more lucrative opportunities and more at-home extremist opportunities for him to join a think tank or whatever the case may be. I mean, how ridiculous is that? And how much does that color how it's bizarre that the Justice Department is taking this route?
Yeah. So this position that Severino claims to want back, this is an unpaid part-time position. Okay. This is not even something that you necessarily put on your resume if you're trying to fit it all into one page. Like, this is really a tertiary gig for Roger Severino, who has already gone to the Ethics and Public Policy Center, this sort of far-right think tank that promotes, what do you know, anti-LGBTQ laws and anti-abortion laws and all of that stuff that Roger Severino loves so much, which led me to wonder, why is he even filing this complaint, which is apparently not a question the Justice Department itself asked when it decided it needed to respond, because the Justice Department, as we've discussed, went with this really extreme argument that is not necessary to counter Severino's suit and seems to walk directly into the trap that I really believe Severino and his allies were trying to set when they were fired from AKUS by Biden.
Yeah. And to me, it's just it's the prioritization of restoring norms and practices as opposed to putting in place guardrails, because there will be another Republican president who will take cues from this and who will be extreme, who will essentially walk back our protections in the way that we aren't even fathoming right now. But unfortunately, we are out of time. That was an excellent discussion. Thank you so much. Mark Stern, staff writer at Slate. He covers the courts and law. You can read all of his work at Slate. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Hey, folks, that's our show today. Thanks so much for joining us. On behalf of Emma Vigeland, I want to say thank you to Heather Parton, and thank you to you for joining us. And a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can support the free show, you can become a member, and you can get extra content over at ROFpodcast.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We will see you, hear you, talk to you again next week. Oh, ain't you sick?